It is Thursday. That means it is Climate Thursday, and we are joined now in the studio by Senior Policy Associate at Duke's Nicholas Institute, Ashley Ward. Ashley, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I was excited that when we were figuring out what we were going to talk about today, you were very excited to talk about the climate provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. So I'm going to give our listeners a little bit of context about what that is, and then I'll ask you to fill in any blanks that I leave out here. This is very brief. The Inflation Reduction Act is a reduced and renegotiated version of the Build Back Better Act. Its goal is to curb inflation by reducing the deficit, lowering prescription drug prices, investing in domestic energy, and promoting clean energy solutions, among other things. It's complicated and large. And it aims to do a whole bunch of different things, but for the purposes of this conversation, we're focusing on the climate components of the bill. So, Ashley, can you give a little more context or tell me what I left out there?
I think my favorite part of this bill is a shift in thinking toward investment and away from regulatory approaches. Not that I'm opposed to regulatory approaches. However, I think what we're doing here is building domestic production for clean energy, providing the starter funds that people need to build the industries that we need. One of the lessons learned from COVID is resilience really has to do with domestic supply chains and how we can recover when a crisis happens. And a lot of what's going on in this bill actually helps us do that and supports U.S. and North American supply chain for clean energy.
I know the last time we spoke, we were talking about how the focus should be more on what can be rather than what we stand to lose. And it seems like that's what you're kind of seeing in this bill, is that instead of like punishing fossil fuel consumption, the idea is that we focus on encouraging what those alternatives are going to be. So could you talk about that a little bit and maybe some of the programs that will actually be doing that?
Right. I think this is a shift from, focusing on supply side, which is mitigating, the production of fossil fuels, and really on the demand side, which is reducing the demand for fossil fuels. And that's, yes, I agree. This is our man on the moon moment, right? How can we get this huge federal initiative moving to where it actually has impact on the ground? And what that looks like is some of these big programs are, extending the tax credits for wind and solar, for electric vehicles, and also at the same time giving $30 billion for the electricity sector to transition to clean energy, which is important. Advanced manufacturing tax credits for wind and solar components and off-wind components, all of these things produced in the U.S. And an important part of these tax credits that I think needs to be people need to be aware of is the ability to receive the tax credits is actually based upon whether or not the item is produced using local, manufacturing, meaning U.S. or North American manufacturing, and by adhering to certain wage thresholds. So we're talking about, a win for labor there, and we're also talking about building that critical supply chain that we need.
So what does this actually look like in our community if this were to pass the way it's written, and we see all these incentives for solar and wind energy and incentive for electric cars? Like, how does that show up, and on what kind of timeline would you think would it show up?
Sure. So as an individual, you're really talking about getting access to tax credits for things like heat pumps, solar, and electric vehicles. That's wonderful. From community standpoint, and I think this is something that, I hope community organizations listening will really dive deep on this, is, community block grants, which are great because it allows these organizations to use the funds in a way that they know will be the most impactful. And then the Clean Energy Accelerator, which is basically a green bank that helps resilience and mitigation projects. An important component to both of these, and this is kind of wonky, but it's important, is this bill allows for direct pay, which is different. So all of these groups that are sort of big tax-exempt groups like NGOs and state and local governments don't have to wait or can't do it because they don't get a tax credit. They actually can get a direct payment, as in the form of a refund from the government to do these things. And more importantly, they can sell those to other people, so other organizations. So if you're an NGO and you want to take advantage of this, you could sell your direct payment to another organization and get revenue for your own organization.
And how do you think that plays out, like, medium and long term?
So medium term, right, it allows those who need the funds most desperately to receive the funds in the immediate, right? They don't have to wait. It also opens up who actually even qualifies for those funds. The other thing is it builds capacity and internally with these organizations, especially when they can sell their credits back. And then long-term, what we're doing, again, is we're talking about structural change. This is an inflection point, really. We're building the infrastructure, not just roads and bridges, right? All of the infrastructure with regard to our manufacturing and industrial infrastructure as well, in order to meet this moment in the long-term.
Excellent. We are visiting with Ashley Ward, Senior Policy Associate at the Nicholas Institute from Duke, and we are talking about the Inflation Reduction Act. And Ashley's very excited about the climate provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act, and that's what we've been talking about. But there are some areas of concern also. So what's not so great in this bill?
I think what we have to keep in mind is this is transformative. You know, there's so many wonderful things about this bill, but it comes at a cost. We're paying a cost for this. And the cost for that is equal leasing on federal land. So basically the Manchin provision was that any federal lands that are leased for wind or solar equally have to be leased for oil and gas. It also withdraws five lease withdrawals for pipelines and other projects that had been ongoing that had been stalled. And it means that any renewable energy development that takes place on federal land and water means that oil and gas on federal land and water also takes place. So in Manchin's terms, this is an all energy. So I just want to caveat what I just said with this, though, however, right? And that is oil and gas industry can't just ramp up on federal lands overnight. The fact that this allows for this to happen doesn't mean it will happen. The fact that the withdrawals for those five pipelines is they've agreed to open those back up, but they're still actively being fought in court with the groups that are opposed to them, and rightfully so. It doesn't mean they will happen. This makes it harder for them to do so, right? But what this means to me is we have to continue to fight in those areas so that we can protect the most vulnerable communities.
So I know there are a lot of people on the left in particular that aren't happy with this bill because they don't think it does enough, or as you were saying, the concessions were too great from the Build Back Better Act. What would your response be to that in general?
I think we have to keep in mind that this would be historic, the largest investment in this that we have had in our nation's history, right? We cannot lose that reality. We also cannot forget that the way in which this is carried out builds capacity in a way in which we haven't yet seen before, right? Really putting resources in the hands of local and state governments so that they can have the greatest impact. It's what, you know, my colleagues who wrote the Resilience Roadmap at the Nicholas Institute identified, you know, two big things, you know, modernizing the federal spending and guidance, which this tries to do, and increasing that federal to local pipeline to building capacity at the local level. These are critical in resilience. And just to give you an idea, in 1980, a quick stat, in 1980, we had an average of $2 billion events happen in the U.S. In the 90s, we had an average of five. In the 2020s, we have $20 billion events that happen in this country every year, which means we're moving from a $1 billion event every 80 days to one every 18 days. There is no greater urgency than community resilience.
How do you define $1 billion event? Is that like a weather event that causes $1 billion
worth
in damage?
It is a NOAA classification when they classify weather events. So it's usually property damage, basically, yes.
We are visiting with Ashley Ward, Senior Policy Associate at the Nicholas Institute at Duke. And I'd like to shift gears and talk politics for just a moment here, because we're very excited about all the climate provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act, but it has not actually passed. It is not actually law. How optimistic are we that this might pass?
I'm trying to be cautiously optimistic. So let's be honest, we don't know what Kristen Sinema thinks about this bill, right? Nobody really understands what she's thinking. It still has to go through the amendment process in the Senate, so we might see some further changes. And then it has to go through the House, which is going to have, you know, its own set of issues and some really tight votes there. But the fact that Manchin was able to negotiate with Schumer on this and come to an agreement is a very good sign, especially given all that stayed in. And this is in particular for underserved communities. Those in the environmental justice community, while they didn't get everything they wanted, a lot of what they had asked for in the Build Back Better remained in this bill.
Excellent. So we've got about a minute left. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you wanted to mention?
I think we need to focus, keep in mind that when it comes to climate extremes and climate change generally, we often talk about this at large scales, at the national scale, the global scale, but the impacts of climate change are felt at the local scale. So it's critically important that we empower communities to build resilience, and that is what this bill does, and that's where we should target our efforts.
All right. Ashley Ward from the Nicholas Institute, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.